This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to Line 1 in the beginning of 2009. I think I'm going to conclude a series of introductory comments for the last month or 6 weeks or so that we've been doing on logical fallacies. What I'm trying to promote is good thinking, and when we listen to arguments trying to sway us in one way or another, I've encouraged that it be important to look at the factual evidence that's being presented as well as the logic being used, and we focused on the logical fallacy aspect of this these issues over the last 6 weeks, and I've given a number of examples and tried to remind people to take emotion out of it and authority out of it and just listen to the logic and the evidence. I've put a link on today's program notes at ksk.org/line1. If you want to find out more information, there's a wonderful link to an article written on this subject by Steve Novella, an adult neurologist at Yale University, if you want more information. The last one of these I want to talk about today is using inconsistency in your logic. It's very, very common. And this one that comes to my mind immediately is related to our own U.S. Congress that might be somewhat incongruous or inconsistent in some of its thinking. For example, the U.S. Congress, appropriately so, has been very much in favor of strong regulation for prescription drugs, which should be – the regulation should be ensuring us of their safety and effectiveness. However, the inconsistency that remains to this day is that they refuse to do anything along the same lines with medicinal herbs and nutritional supplements, both of which are clearly pharmacological agents. These are still being sold with no regulation as to their ability to be safe or effective. And so you want to kind of realize that these kinds of issues are throughout our society, and it would help to understand these issues a little bit more. Finally, I guess as a conclusion to this whole series, I'd remind everybody some of the best arguments that we need to examine in this way are our own beliefs and our own thoughts. And that finally gets me to one of the best bumper stickers that I remember seeing, which said, quote, "Don't believe all that you believe," end quote. Today, my guest is Dr. Tamar Chansky. This is Dr. Chansky's second visit on our program. I've interviewed her after she wrote a previous book called Freeing Your Child from Anxiety, and that book was, I think, the second book she'd written. The first one was Freeing Your Child from Obsessive Compulsive Disorder. She's the founder and director of the Children's Center for Obsessive Compulsive Disorder and Anxiety in Philadelphia, where she lives with her husband and two daughters and still finds time to generate some excellent, excellent books for the public about anxiety disorders. Her most recent book is getting into, I think, the way I understand it, her preventing some of these issues. It's called Freeing Your Child from Negative Thinking. Dr. Chansky, welcome again to Line One.
Oh, thank you. Great to be here.
So you've decided that maybe we need to be trying to prevent some of these anxiety disorders and depression, and somehow negative thinking creeps into that.
Exactly, exactly. That there's just so many ways that if parents are have their ears tuned to the telltale signs of some of these thinking patterns, that they may be able to change them way before any diagnosis takes shape.
So are you then, in a sense, talking about that little discussion that goes on in our minds all the time, not everybody else is aware of, that we're saying and thinking about things in our own mind?
Exactly. I would say it's a normal first stop in our processing of events that happen in our lives to have some negative thoughts about what just happened. And negative thoughts are really the narrative or the commentary that we have about our lives. And, the tone of it is in such a way that it exaggerates what's wrong in the picture to the exclusion of what might be right. And so the result of that kind of thinking is that we feel much more overwhelmed than we really need to about what just happened.
So I guess a simple way to have people thinking about it that dawned on me when you were saying this is that it's we all know that there's people who see the glass half full and some who see the glass half empty.
Right. That's right. And so if we can understand that even, you know, while there may be folks who tend to be able to see the glass half full, and that's really fortunate, that even those people at times may have those first thoughts that are negative. They may move more quickly over to a more realistic perspective. I think this is a nice tie-in to what you were talking about, the logical fallacy issue, and just that the antidote to that is thinking about the facts and not the emotions. That's really what we're talking about here. Some people might think, oh, this is about positive thinking, and you have to, you know, see that everything is rosy. And it's not really the case. It's about seeing things accurately, because when we see things realistically, our lives become more manageable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I fell into that trap when I'm just thinking about some of the questions that I thought about asking you, and I fell into the trap of thinking about positive psychology, which is distinctly different, as you're pointing out. It's just doing this, is it right to say cognitive behavioral therapy, which to me is just making people see things as they really are and educate them about what's real and what's and how their thinking has gone astray, rather than positive psychology?
Yeah, but I think actually, you know, positive psychology is a movement that Dr. Marty Seligman here at Penn started, about 10 years ago, that's really focusing on optimal living rather than sort of what helps folks to live more optimally, that's a role of psychology as opposed to just looking for clinical conditions and diagnoses. So it's not, you know, positive psychology isn't just about being positive. It's okay. About, you know, how to use our strengths and resources and really, you know, see ourselves as not as passive and as being able to impact our world.
Okay. In my mind, just the way it works, the little guy in my mind immediately starts asking, you know, when we talk about things like this, and I think about children and my experiences watching children grow up and seeing them grow up in my practice, is it nature or nurture, or is it a combination of the two? And I know sometimes there's not just succinct answers, but I love to talk about that. What are your thoughts about how this tendency to have too much negative thinking perhaps gets started in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that in terms of nature, there are kids who you can tell from early on they're more troubled about things. They notice things that other kids aren't aware of. When they're upset about things, it seems to stick around longer. They're just naturally, the way they come into the world is maybe have less flexibility. They get stuck more. But you know, there's good news for those children as well, that these skills of learning how to deal with disappointment, with losing, with things that go wrong, there are skills that you can learn and put to use, and you can become more flexible and more resilient. But I think also that there are some kids maybe who have those tendencies and then may grow up in a family where negative thinking is more in charge of the household, and that only reinforces their ideas that they're not able to do things, or when things go wrong, it really is hopeless. So I guess both factors can come into play.
Right. You know, I've been consistently or commonly impressed with how you can see the same kinds of temperamental qualities in one or two parents, as you might see in their offspring, but they're mixed in with their offspring very much like their physical qualities or their appearance, and recognize it very, very early. I love asking parents the difference between what appear to be identical twins very early in life and what they notice. And so there are clearly things in our genes that make us the way they are, but I would also agree we're learning that the environment has an impact on that. So I guess what I'm getting at is it would appear to me, and I'm asking you to straighten me out, have some genetic predisposition to this, good parenting, good recognition by the environment, and understanding can ameliorate or change what might be an undesirable outcome in issues like this.
That's right. That's right. And I think that it's a top-down venture where if parents can be aware of their thinking patterns, then they will be able to help mm-hmm. their child have healthier thinking mm-hmm. patterns. So the kind of caricature of that really could happen to any of us, so I'm not pointing fingers, but you know, the parent who comes in saying he is so negative, everything he says is negative, and here you have a parent who's basically being very negative. And you know, so one of the terms that I coined in the book is interactional optimism. So it's this idea that the more that parents can not exaggerate their child's negativity, see it as temporary, as changeable, as flexible, that they will then be encouraging those qualities in their children as well. So it's really, it's a two-person job is another way of thinking of it.
Let me remind our listeners, my guest today is Tamar Chansky. She's a author and psychologist. Her most recent book is Freeing Your Child from Negative Thinking. She's written extensively on anxiety and obsessive-compulsive disorders in childhood and is in director of a large center in Philadelphia on these topics. If you have questions today, comments, please feel free to give us a call. Let me give you a couple of ways to get a hold of us. Locally, 550-8433, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email me at line1, at kska.org. Also, remember that you can go to our website and listen to the program at any time. There are some links on the website today of Dr. Chansky's website and the Anxiety Disorders Association of America, as well as the Positive Psychology Center, which we've mentioned earlier at the University of Pennsylvania. So 550-8433. So Dr. Chansky, when you're dealing with children, you're often having to talk to parents as well and help them understand how their thinking and acting out may influence or even promulgate or continue negative thinking in children.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you know, it's a great opportunity to model. I have to be careful. You see, it just keeps going. I can't be negative with the parents because then I've So what I do when I'm observing that is I might just point out the behavior, for instance, saying, "Wow, you know, I wonder what you're thinking about this," or "It sounds like, you know, this is something that you don't think can change. Is that really how you see this, or is it just how you're feeling in the moment?" Because that's exactly what a parent could then say to a child who, you know, comes home with a disappointing grade or something and says, you know, I'm going to quit school, nothing ever works. So the parent, rather than rushing in to correct the child's logic, which will not go over well in that moment, rather empathizing and saying, you know, "Boy, it sure sounds like this just doesn't look good to you. Is that really what you think, or is that just you're just feeling really bad right now?"
Mm-hmm.
So it's a gift that keeps on giving.
The subtitle of your book is something I also want to explore a little bit. It says "Powerful Practical Strategies to Build a Lifetime of Resilience, Flexibility, and Happiness." So Let's define what you're meaning by resilience and flexibility, and then maybe delve into how, you know, getting away from this negative thinking can help us with this resilience and happiness and flexibility.
Yeah, I think that resilience is the opportunity to be able to switch sets. It has to do with flexibility. Flexibility is part of resilience, but that to have different versions of the story of what's going on in your life, whether we're talking about an everyday kind of adversity that might come up for, say, a child, a friend snubbing them at lunch, or, again, not doing well in a class, or something more serious like the illness of a parent or something along those lines, that the first thought is the world is ending in mm-hmm. either of those scenarios, really. And then being able to move through different versions of what is happening to be able to see what opportunities they do have, to be able to see things in perspective, what part of the situation can they control, what can't they control. So it's really, again, seeing yourself as an active agent in your life story.
And the flexibility is part of that, being able to be flexible enough in your thinking to realize that it's not the end of the world to have a bad grade or lose a friend or someone kidded you in a pretty hurtful way or something, that you can look at it in a different framework. Is that the full term, full way you're using the idea of flexibility?
Right. Not getting stuck with your initial reaction to something. I, as a cognitive behavior therapist, I think of both the thinking aspect of flexibility in terms of telling yourself a different story about what's happening, but also the more behavioral aspect of it, which is seeing that there might be some things that you could do differently to create a different outcome. Maybe you need to approach the friend differently, or you need to speak up, that there are things that you can always do to impact your world.
And the final thing, I guess, that comes to my mind from the title, the end of the title of Powerful Practical Strategies to Build a Lifetime of Resilience, Flexibility, and Happiness, it implies that if we can promote this flexibility, resilience, and a more honest evaluation of these situations, that you're saying that we have evidence and belief that leads to more happiness, and the opposite of that is more anxiety, depression, and unhappiness. Is that right?
Right. So, the place that these kinds of thought patterns can lead is to kids just getting into the habit of thinking negatively.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, it becomes so automatic for them that they begin to lose that flexibility. They begin to withdraw more from what's going on in their lives, and that, that's the path to anxiety and depression. But the spiral can work the other way, that as you are able to free yourself from those negative views about things, you can pursue more of what, brings satisfaction in your life. And that's one way of thinking about happiness.
As I think a key word that I heard you just say to me was this, making it a habit. And as we're learning, and as I think you must think about now, is that we're learning from neuroscience, is that we do set up kind of pathways that get reinforced, much like learning to ride a bike, and those kind of pathways are what we go back to even in how we think, and that those pathways can be adapted and changed, particularly early in life. Is that how you think about cognitive behavioral therapy, or this particular way of talking and learning to talk to kids?
Yes, absolutely. I tell kids, whether it's we're talking about worry or about negative thinking, I'll say, you know, you if you are worrying and you worry more, you become a really good worrier. It becomes so automatic, it's effortless. But if you create a new habit of being able to think more realistically, you get really good at that as well. And you can't just want to do that. You need to practice it. It needs to become a new habit. But then over time, your brain really gets good at that too, and it takes much less effort to get over to that kind of thinking. So it's really, that's why, you know, we were talking earlier about the idea of prevention, that if parents can be tuned in to hearing these kind of buzzwords of never, you know, I'll never be able to do this, nothing ever goes well, I always lose, what, you know, things like that, those absolutes, that they can begin to shape some new responses in those situations and create new patterns for kids so they don't get stuck in the negative.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have some questions that brings up, but we do have a caller on the line, so I want to go ahead and take Herman. Herman, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes, this is Herman Walker. How you doing, Dr. Woodard? You happen to be the doctor for my two children, Dupree and Lucero.
Uh-huh.
And it's a very fascinating topic. And I just want to make a couple of comments and then have a question. One of the comments that I have is this is a philosophy that we try to perpetuate in my family with my two daughters who are 10 and 8. And one of the things that we do is we have a saying, can't is not in the walk of vocabulary. So the word can't is not a word we try to use around the house. In other words, you know, if there's a way to figure it out or you need to ask for some help, we can help you attain and achieve. And that includes down to staying happy and staying positive. The other philosophy, family model that we have instead of philosophy, that my kids have been saying this since they were babies, is you think it, you create it, you feel it to believe it, you know it to have it. And in incorporating all of that to our children, I think anyway, are happy, understanding, you know, that they're kids. And I think that this topic that you're talking about now is very important in light of today's society and all the negativity that's out there and that they deal with when they go to school. My kids come home all the time and talk about, you know, such and such was sad or what's going on in their lives, and there's a lot of depressed kids out there, and I think it does stem from the home.
Mm-hmm.
So those are my comments. My question is, I had a situation last night with my one daughter, who's a Dupree, who we were watching The Great Debaters, and that's a Denzel Washington movie, and there was a scene in there where they lynched an African-American man, and it really traumatized her because she couldn't understand it. And so my question is, how do you stay positive when you're learning about history and seeing things that are in historical light, and they're trying to understand why, how, and how can that be, and how can we treat people like that in light of the philosophy that I'm trying to teach my children? So that's my question.
Wonderful, wonderful question. Yep.
Wow. Thank you very much for that question, because I think that, you know, that just really captures what the challenges are for the world today, that, you know, while we're trying to promote resilience in our kids and help them not get stuck with a negative, that there are a lot of things that are real that are happening in the world that are very distressing and, you know, that they are going to be exposed to, either we will expose them to it or their friends or school. And I think that, you know, so you were talking about the sayings that you have in your household, Herman, and one of the things that we say in our household a lot is, you know, the world is not a perfect place. Here's the example of that today, you know, so when things come up, just not to have the expectations that things always go right. I mean, I think that with something as serious as what you're describing that your daughter saw in the movie, that, you know, certainly the first response is just to support her in what her reactions are to it, that if she's feeling outraged, upset, whatever reaction she might have, to really bring that out and hear her, because that is something that it's so important that, you know, how are we going to make changes in the world if we're not encouraging children to be truthful to their own reactions to things? So I don't, you know, that may seem like a small step, that what we want to do is to be teaching our kids things, but I really think that part of how the teaching happens is reinforcing, you know, true reactions to just to horrific things that have happened in the world. And then I think, though, that you're asking how, you know, what do you do to not have kids be traumatized by learning about history, that part of what we do with that kind of information is really to reinforce for children how so many people feel exactly the same way that they do, and that they are working to not have those kinds of things happen in the world. It may, again, seem like an obvious thing to say, but kids, you know, a very common experience for children is feeling like they're the only one who feels this way. And so letting them know that that's not the case, and also that the people who have a lot of power have the same views as they do, and that they're working to make the world safe for everyone, that those kinds of just stating the obvious, in a sense of just setting up how the world really works, can be reassuring to kids when you can't take away the fact that bad things happen.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of how I dealt with it. You know, I let her know that was in the past, it's historical, and that's part of our history, but look at today. You know, today we have an African-American president, and times mm-hmm. have changed, and fortunately we move on. And part of that moving on is maintaining a positive, happy attitude about the world, knowing that tomorrow's a new day. And so that's kind of how I dealt with it. But her reaction was just was enlightening to me, opening to me, how she reacted so strongly to it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all
you
I
know,
have.
When,
thank you.
Yeah, I mean, what I just say, I have the pleasure of working with so many kids who are so sensitive in my practice, and I, when they will say, you know, we saw a movie at school, or somebody, you know, told me about something that happened, and they're so upset by it, and I will tell them that that's part of their humanity, that, you know, they're just really very in touch with their reactions, and that's, you know, that's a good thing in a sense, and, you know, that we need people in the world who feel outraged when things are, you know, not right, but that sometimes those feelings can really get overwhelming for kids. As a therapist who works primarily with kids with anxiety disorders, some kids really, you know, they have a hard time just moving on from those kinds of days, and it starts to pile up where they feel really frightened about things. And so that's why, like you said, you know, pointing out what's different about now and then, or what other people are doing to help them feel safe and to be safe in the world, it's very important to just, you know, lay that out for them.
Thank you very much, and keep up the good work, Dr. Woodard.
Yeah, well, thanks very much for the call. It was a very interesting segue into this topic, and I appreciate your efforts as a parent.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Let me remind our listeners, if you've got questions about what you're listening to today and would like to ask Dr. Chansky some questions, 550-8433. We're talking about anxiety. We're going to probably touch on depression, if I were to guess. And Dr. Chansky's new book is Freeing Your Child from Negative Thinking, which I want to continue to remind listeners to think about getting. It's a way to think about preventing some of these more common psychological issues in childhood that unfortunately permeate on into adulthood. And it's a very important aspect of being a parent, is to help our kids start with some very good mental health habits early in life. But 550-8433, our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us at line1, LINEONE, at kska.org. Dr. Chansky, let's investigate the interrelationship then between negative thinking, as you see it, and anxiety, depression, and maybe even the obsessive compulsive disorder. I'll let you kind of see if you can tie those in for our listeners a little better.
Sure. Yeah. When I first wrote this book, some people who knew of my other work on anxiety said, "Wait a minute, I don't understand what negative thinking is. Isn't that the same as anxiety?" And the distinction that I make is that anxiety is anxious thinking is all about the what ifs, what's going to happen, catastrophizing about, what's next and will I be able to do okay? Will things go all right? Will I mess up? It's a lot of questions, whereas negative thinking I think of as more a lot of statements or conclusions about things not working. Nothing works out for me. It never will. There's no point. I shouldn't try. Why bother? So the sort of though people can certainly, have either or both, the quality of the thinking is slightly but importantly different. So what you want to do with an anxious child who has all these questions is to help them think more realistically about what they're anticipating. And with a child with negative thinking, you want to turn those statements more back into questions, not assuming that things are going to go wrong, but helping the child really think through what's going to happen and be able to look at it more realistically, but get out of that place of being paralyzed or giving up, not trying because they just have decided there's no point. Obsessive compulsive disorder, is an anxiety disorder, and it's different in the sense of kids with OCD the kinds of things that they worry about, I would say, are different from what we might think of as a typical worry for a child. Worry might be, typical worry for kids might be about, having robber, being worried about their safety at night. Is someone going to come into the house, or worrying about how they're going to do on a test, or feeling embarrassed about giving a book report? Whereas a child with OCD, the worries are a little bit less logical. They may think because they touched something that was red, and red is the color of blood, that now they, they don't really believe this, but they feel very frightened that now that they've touched this, red shirt, that means that they're touching blood and they could get sick from that. So that there are these lapses of logic that happen with OCD that are different from the other disorders. The good news about all of this is that these are all treatable conditions. The outcomes for kids are really very good. So if any parents are listening and are concerned about this, certainly looking into treatment is a very promising avenue.
I'd just like to echo, just kind of preparing for this program, I read an editorial that was just recently in the New England Journal of Medicine about childhood anxiety, and it stated factually some things that make sense, but I really hadn't a thought of it in that way, and that's that anxiety, that the younger the onset and the more severe it is, the poorer the outcomes for adults and adolescents, and then the corollary of that is that failure to identify these anxiety issues increases the rates of anxiety and depression and substance abuse and even educational unachievement have been associated with that later in life. So it gets back to this being a very educated parent and being aware of this. You can have big impacts potentially in the lives of your children. I don't want to make it sound too overdramatic, but I think that's kind of what's part of the importance of this issue about negative thinking and understanding anxiety to me.
Right. And I think that the other way of thinking about this, and what I really tried to do in the book, is to make this fairly simple for families. So it's not like, wow, we have, you know, we have to start this whole new program and you know, that's overwhelming. I can't, you know, then their negative thinking will start. That's I can't do it. That's too much. We can't make those changes. But really to just, again, tuning the ears to some of the catchphrases that kids tend to say that is the red flag for negative thinking, and just not, you know, not immediately jumping to change that, but just pointing out what, you know, what the parent is hearing from the child, and making that a moment where something different could happen, whether it's with a younger child saying, you know, wow, that negative bug is flying around again. Do you hear it? It's just, all it can say is, you know, never, 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 never. Boy, what do you want to say to that guy? Or, you know, with an older child just saying, you know, wow, it sounds like all the negative is just rushing in. Do you think you could think about this differently now, or do you want to take a break and come back to it? But just not leaving it as something that has to stay the way it is in its original form. That's, you know, that's something that it's free. It's easy once you have your ear out for it. It's something that can really change a family very dramatically. I think my own family started out pretty positive, but in the course of writing this book, it only improved, I have to say, which was great.
A reason for parents to do it is, I mean, there's no better way to be to learn something than to teach it, so to speak. So the more, I think maybe the parents come out the better for it if they embrace this this book and some of your suggestions. Let me remind our listeners again, my guest is Tamar Tansky. We're talking about her book, Freeing Your Child from Negative Thinking, which gets us into anxiety, another of her areas of expertise. So if you've got questions or comments about the parenting issues related to this, or your children, or your own experiences with anxiety, you can reach us in a couple of ways. Locally, 550-8433, 550-8433, a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and emailing at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E at KSKA.org. Remember, we'll be done here at about 3 o'clock local time. You'll hear the replay from between 7 and 8, and you can always come back and listen to the program at any time, or even subscribe to the podcast in the usual ways. A tangential question, but it certainly must have some pertinence, and maybe others have thought about it, is how long does it take us as humans to change habits or ways of thinking? I know that it has to have a number of variables depending on age and environment and so forth, and genetics perhaps. How do you answer that kind of question?
Well, I'll answer that in a few different ways. The most homey example, I would say, is that when I keep losing my keys, if I want to make a new habit of putting them in one place and always doing that, it takes about 3 weeks to establish a kind of habit like that. So for behavioral patterns, research has shown that it takes about 3 weeks. With more thinking patterns, the typical length of treatment in a research setting for anxiety and depression is usually about 16 to 20 sessions. So, you know, that's about 4 or 5 months to establish, and really establish to the point of being able to maintain those habits without the treatment. So that's what happens in a research setting. But I think that if families, what's really can be a lovely thing to happen, and that my patients will report this, that sometimes even the child who was not coming into treatment, maybe it was the sibling of that child, begins to pick up on the language and will say something like, you know, that's that all or none thing. Mm-hmm. We're not supposed to do, you know, it's not about all or none, it's about some. You know, like the caller had said, he, you know, can't is not in the family vocabulary, and I think that kids do pick up on these ideas. So then you have, as you make this process more overt, your parents aren't the only one training everybody. Sort of everybody jumps on board and can be helpful with this. So it's these ideas are getting reinforced in just very spontaneous ways in a family. So I think that that helps the process pick up faster. But I just want to highlight that one of the areas that I apply these kinds of ideas to very frequently in my work has to do with learning and education, because so much of where negative thinking can spring from in kids anyway is about not being able to get things right in school.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when their frustration about not being able to learn something or not doing as well as they'd like leads them to these sweeping conclusions about their abilities in general. And so you have kids saying, I'm not smart, I can't do anything right. And again, those are the red flags that what you would want, what a parent would want to do in that situation is to, first of all, empathize with what's going on with a child so that they know that we are hearing them. You know, you're really frustrated. You had a bad day, or this was really hard for you. And then try to help them narrow down what was it that actually happened. You know, they've decided that they can't learn anymore, or at least that's what they're saying, and it probably comes down to one thing that went wrong on a test, for instance. That helps to make the problem much more manageable for them. If they're, you know, if we've decided the problem is that they're not, you know, they're not smart, boy, how do you go about solving that? That's pretty big. But if you can shrink it down to, you know, I don't know how to do word problems in math, or I need help with that, that's something that you can then start to address. So one word that I like to use a lot is, or one phrase is, not yet. A lot of kids will say, you know, in my practice, I don't know how to do this. And I'll say, wait, what are the other two words that you're missing? And they say, I know, not yet. Because they will learn. There's, you know, the learning curve. They need to, I think one of the ways of buffering negative thinking is understanding how the world works, that adults didn't get to be as wise as we are just like that. We had to work at it. And so when kids don't know how to do something, to be clear with them that this is just something that they haven't figured out yet, and that will help them keep the door open to keep trying.
All right. And we've got a caller. It looks like there may be a question about success in school as well, which is on this topic. Ramona, you're on line one.
I am.
What can we do for you?
Well, my problem is really goes much deeper than I can't do that yet.
Mm-hmm.
My son is in seventh grade, and he's experiencing his third year of lack of success. We are currently in counseling. I left no stone unturned to find out what we could do to help him. He has recently been diagnosed with ADD. Whether that is going to, you know, really be the issue or not, it's still too early to see. He started on medication. This is the first day of a new semester. He doesn't say that he's feeling badly, but I suspect that he is, and I've noticed great signs of depression. He tries very hard, but he doesn't do as well as his intelligence mm-hmm. should shows. When he in his yearly tests, the grades or the scores are all in the advanced, but the school grades do not reflect that, and he studies hard and he doesn't get this. So how do I help him as a parent through this third year of lack of success?
Yeah, Ramona, you that is a very difficult situation that you're in right now, seeing your child really not having his educational needs met potentially for 3 years, and for him having to you know, struggle with that and really absorb that. I often will see kids who do have signs of depression when they've had a learning disorder, learning disability that has not been identified or has not been addressed appropriately in a school, that they just start to feel like it is them, instead of, you know, that things need to change in their learning environment. So it sounds like you do have something new to go on at this point with the diagnosis of ADHD. But of course, then there's the question of what kinds of things the school will be able to do to put in place so that, you know, the accommodations are there to work around his learning difference. And there are many groups that have wonderful, thinking of one, the CHAD is the name of the group online. You may have already discovered that. And I believe that they have sample IEPs and 504 plans so that they have the kinds of accommodations that typically work well for kids with ADD, so that you can work with your school district to make sure that there are changes in the classroom. I mean,
He's actually in the gifted program, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. this makes me wonder whether they work with these IEPs, and I understand now there's this 504, and I'm getting all this vocabulary.
Right.
Is one even allowed to ask for that when they're in something such as the gifted program?
Yes, because an individualized educational plan, what that is to do is to make sure that the law, that every child is entitled to a free and accessible education, is being followed. So your son, along with many, many other kids, have the combination of having, you know, gifted IQ and having learning differences. It's not unusual. And so they just, you know, the school needs to add to the gifted IEP, if that's what he has, the other accommodations. Okay, and that's fine, but they need to take into account all of the things that he needs in order to be successful and engaged academically.
Mm-hmm.
So
how can I as a parent talk to him in a more positive way? Because it at some point, you know, you get really frustrated.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You get frustrated with his behavior yourself, or with just feeling frustrated about his situation vis-a-vis the school?
Probably both. And the thing is, he's not hyperactive. He just simply is a nice kid.
Inattentive.
Doesn't succeed as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he's not cutting up in class. He's just, he's having trouble with attention.
Right,
and
right.
When he's supposed to be paying attention, the teacher may be explaining an algebra problem to him. He's watching three other kids across the room.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And right. You know, I knew this was going on a long time ago, but it took me to go to a specialist to get this part figured out. Mm-hmm. But how do I boost his ego? Because it's, you know, we've really been in the dumps.
Right. You know, how I would think about that, Ramona, is that the best way to, or the first way to help him think more positively about himself is to help him understand what went wrong. Because he's gifted. Even if he weren't gifted, but he is, that the system has not met his needs. Now there are things that are going to be in place that you'll be working on to help him succeed, but that he needs to get the explanation right about what went wrong. So, you know, it wasn't his fault. It was a combination of not knowing exactly what was going on with him, or you knew. But not having that identified, and so the school was not putting into place. It's like not knowing that you need glasses. It's very hard to see. But when you find out that you need them, well, the world can really start to change when you get those glasses. So, mm-hmm. But it's a no fault kind of thing.
Okay.
So I think that the main the main place that I would start is just helping him to learn the tough lesson of what happened here, but that things should change at this point, and certainly his input is going to be really important, along the way to see, is the school following the recommendations that are given? Are they helping him? I mean, he's got to be part of the team. I think that will be another way for him to feel less disenfranchised or helpless, that, he needs to participate in the process. But I'm sure that, there is loss that you feel about this, and that he does too, just of not having known and not having his needs met for all these years. That, that's a real thing to talk about, and I think then you can get to the other side of it. But that's the truth of what has happened.
So what I'm hearing,
even though he understands
you say is
about his lack of concentration, but I hear what you're saying is to take it further and to explain to him that it wasn't his fault, and that, as much as he was trying, and probably even the teachers were trying, they weren't going maybe about it in the right way. And then, like you said, I guess I need to go to the school and get the tools that the law has given us to allow for help with, like you said, the IEP.
Yeah, it's fixable.
That's right.
Yeah,
and that's something they haven't even suggested. I'm going to have to go to them and ask for it, I guess.
Right. Well, it gets down to the practicalities and money and everything. And I think another website I would encourage also, and I'll see if Dr. Chansky would agree, is Mel Levine has been a big authority in North Carolina on this. He has founded a website called allkindsofminds.org, and his whole premise is that we all have different kinds of minds. They all work in different ways, and the true way we ought to be educating kids is to figure out what stimulates their minds the best. And in a lot of what's going on now in this country is identifying those kids and helping those kids that are two grades behind. It doesn't mean you're not at risk for depression or anxiety, and you're still very, very smart and not two grades behind. And that's where the rubber meets the road, in my mind at least.
Mm-hmm.
And the medications can work, although a lot of kids with attentional problems also have other learning disabilities. They may have trouble with working memory, different kinds of memory. And I'm not saying that he does or not, but the better you understand how his mind works, the better you get options. And these are treatable options, I think, is how I would like to think about it. Dr. Chansky, is that what you're saying also?
Absolutely, absolutely. It gets to be, though, you just, like you said, you need to know what your son's issues are so those can be addressed, because not everybody, even though now you've sort of narrowed the scope to ADD, within that, there are different kinds of, struggles that may be there, but they can all be addressed. The most important thing, I think, is, for him to know he's not a bad kid. Because he has it, or he's not, what has happened to this point is not a sign of what his future is going to be. Now you have a new idea, you have new tools, and so things should really change for him.
Well, that sounds really great. Yeah, his lack of concentration has, as was explained to me by the counselor, inhibits his ability to memorize things. Mm-hmm. There are some things, like he's very articulate, he's an excellent speller, mm-hmm. but the new theories, such as in algebra, or the things that need some research, or remembering what his homework assignment is, those are the real key issues. Because if it doesn't go into his working memory, he can't retrieve it, is what I've been told.
Right. And there are some strategies that psychologists can also help help with those kinds of things, like having a little memory gadget to write down the things that need to be done at the end of the day, and reinforcing using that and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks, you guys. Really appreciate it. Here comes my kiddo, and thank you so much for your help.
All right. Another thing, Dr. Shansky, that that brings to my mind is a note that I got on my little cheat sheet here to remember, which I may have gotten from your book, is recognizing and cultivating the strengths that kids have is also an important part of this. We all have some weaknesses. I get kidded about my ability to sing, and I don't have to go to school and sing every day, thank God. But we all have strengths that we need to keep building on as well.
Right, and that, you know, it's what all children need to experience is that their gift is of use to people.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I agree with your recommendation about the Mel Levine's literature, because there are just some wonderful stories that he writes in there about his experiences with kids who, you know, may have been struggling in school, but it just was incumbent upon the adults around him to figure out what he was good at and how he approached things, and so he could begin to see how he could contribute. So I think, you know, that is a really important piece of the puzzle as well.
We're, unbelievably to me, these hours sometimes work very fast, and this has been one of them. We're coming down with just a couple of minutes left, and I think I'd best use this time to let you sum up the important issues you want to make sure people have heard about in the last minute or so.
Sure. So I just we'll go back to this idea that even if there are signs early on of negative thinking in kids, and that it really is a natural part of the learning process for most of us, that the more that parents are tuned in to what the signs are of kids getting into these negative thinking patterns, thinking in absolutes, thinking all or none, if they can't do this, they can't do anything, if it's not working now, it's never going to work, hearing those telltale signs and beginning to help the child look at those conclusions that they're reaching or the story that they're telling themselves about that moment, and helping them to create a more accurate and more adaptive version of the story of their lives.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. I want to express my appreciation for you taking the time again, Dr. Shansky, to be with us, and encourage our listeners to look you up on the Internet and look at your website and then look at some of the books, in particular your most recent one, Freeing Your Child from Negative Thinking.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
It's been enjoyable for me as well. Good luck.
Thank you.
Next week, Line One's going to return. We're going to be doing something a little bit differently, and one of those things I've never done before, and that's we're going to look at the issue of genetic counseling. We've talked about genetics in a number of ways, but, you know, the rubber meets the road when you have specific issues, and we're going to try to come up with 10 or 15 very common reasons why people might need a genetic counselor for you to discuss. So if you've got questions or comments, next week will be your chance with Maggie Miller and Audrey Burke, who are genetic counselors here in Anchorage. So tune into your health and learn more Monday, January 2nd at 2 p.m. Remember, we repeat the same evening at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1. For KSKA and for Line 1, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line 1, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at kska.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.